This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Well, the sight of melting, graying snow can be a real inspiration when it comes to making travel plans. So this hour, we're going to be talking about some sensational destination spots far and near and how to best get there. If you're on a budget, ways to cut corners without sacrificing enjoyment. If flying is not your thing, we'll look at the alternatives. We'll also discuss security concerns, travel insurance, and health questions like the Zika virus. How do we get medical help abroad? What role does insurance play? We've got lots to talk about. And joining us are Seth Kugel. Seth writes the Frugal Traveler column for the New York Times. Welcome, Seth, to Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. And Don George is author of the new book, The Way of Wanderlust, and also is travel writer and editor for National Geographic Traveler magazine. Hello, Don.
Hello, Mary. It's great to be here.
Thanks. So let's talk first about trends. Are people traveling abroad for the most part these days, or are they staying close? It was just November, of course, when the attacks happened in Paris. So what are you hearing? Don, let's go to you first.
I think that there's always a certain reticence immediately after some horrible news like the Paris attacks and other attacks, but people are resilient and they begin to travel abroad again relatively quickly for the most part, I think. But of course, domestic travel is really popular. The national parks celebrating their anniversary. It's certainly domestic travel is going to be big, big this year. But I think that people are going back to going overseas too, and it's heartening to me to see that.
Mm. Seth, what are your thoughts about traveling safety? What does a traveler need to take into consideration?
I think that people tend to misjudge what's risky when they're traveling. I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, but I'm absolutely sure that most accidents and deaths and serious injuries take place on public transportation in developing countries, for example. Mm. So instead of worrying about a terrorist attack, of course you should worry about everything, but instead of a terrorist attack, you should be thinking more like, well, am I traveling safely within the country on the highways, for example?
What should your research look like, Seth, then?
You should look at traffic safety. There's plenty of information online about traffic safety in various countries, about emergency services and stuff like that. And I do take buses, and I always take buses, but I just realize what the risk is there. Also, you should be aware of what the crime rates are in the various cities you're visiting. You know, these days you can, of course, find all of this stuff online, but then not to be too scared either. You're at risk in your own home. I mean, I live in New York City, so, you know, I could get hit by a car crossing the street in Times Square.
So. Okay, fair enough. So for those of us who are feeling a bit beaten up by the blizzard this past weekend, let's get into some exciting warm spots. I did want to talk about Cuba. There are still travel restrictions. You have to travel not as a tourist, but for educational or humanitarian purposes. As of now, you still need to get there by charter. But do you find there's a sense of let's get there before development kicks in? Don?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, from what I'm hearing from people in Cuba, development is kicking in really, really quickly. The number of tourists there, American tourists there, of course, is just skyrocketing. And so a place that used to have maybe one bus in a week of one busload of visitors in a week now has six in a day. And so there is certainly a sense of urgency, and it's probably a well-placed sense of urgency to try to get there as soon as possible. On the other hand, as time goes by, probably more and more areas will be open to travelers. And so the well-trod places, you'll go beyond and you'll see other new places. So I think people should try to get to Cuba whenever they can get there. But if you can get there quicker, go.
Seth, you tend to avoid, I think, tourist hotspots, if I'm hearing correctly. What is Cuba? Is Cuba appealing to you?
Yeah, Cuba is an amazing destination. I think that it's also become much, much easier, not even in terms of legality, but just in terms of comfort in the last few years. I was last in Cuba in 2003, and you basically couldn't get a good meal anywhere but the sort of exclusive tourist spots. You couldn't really get across the country very easily. Now things are just, at least from what I hear, getting so, so much better. I think the best thing about visiting Cuba is basically interacting with people and finding out their past and their stories of the last decade. So I would just, I'm not against going to Cuba right now. I think it's an okay time to go. There still are the limits. You still have to, you know, go jump through a few hoops to get there. So, you know, there's not, I guess, when that ends, there's going to be massive crowds and probably resorts and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But I would just recommend that when people think of going to Cuba, they don't think of just like a tropical, exotic location, but a place to really learn about history and what it means to have gone through, you know, one of the last communist regimes. And my memories of Cuba, I've been, and I went twice, are all about talking to people. So even if you do go on some sort of organized tour, you know, be sure to try to, you know, escape the minders, so to speak, when you're there.
Let's talk about cuisine for just a moment. Seth, do you find that the best cuisine tends to be outside the tourist hotspots? And if that's so, how do you find it?
Certainly there is great cuisine in the tourist hotspots because that often those are the expensive, fancy restaurants. Of course, the average experience in a tourist hotspot is to get ripped off and all that. So
I guess the most unusual and perhaps the most authentic. Maybe that's what I was trying to get at there.
Sure. Well, I mean, there's two kinds of authentic, right? There's like the hot restaurants that are using, you know, the whole modern trend of having chefs taking the local cuisine and elevating it. That's not quite what I'm into. You know, my job is budget travel. So there's a couple of things you can do. First of all, these online resources are great these days. You know, I don't recommend overusing TripAdvisor. But TripAdvisor has a massive catalog of restaurants in tons and tons of places outside of city centers. Also, local food blogs are probably the best way to find stuff. And there's probably a local food blog in English in every single place in the world. And then you can also use Google Translate to translate sort of local blogs as well, which actually works better and better every day. My favorite method, however, is, of course, the old asking local people. Now, there's a certain way to do this and a certain way not to do this. If you just ask kind of in a normal way, people will just kind of give you what they think you want to hear, which tends to be places that are not, you know, they're still on the beaten path. They might be sort of have a menu in English or something like that. So I like to ask people, like, where's the last place they went out to eat with their family? That's the sort of question that I think. And I also sometimes actually sort of semi-threaten people jokingly. I say, okay, I want you to send me to a place, and if I see one other tourist there, I'm going to come right back and take it out on you.
So Don, let's get to you for a moment. If you had to, if you were to head to, say, Botswana's Okavango Delta, which has gotten some raves as a destination point, some of the homegrown specialties for the menu include a blue and green caterpillar that's served deep fried as a snack. How do you, as a wanderer, approach exotic food? What is the best way to do that? Look at it and go, oh, that's interesting. Or how do you dive in without and keep your sense of feeling good?
I think you just dive in and say, this is another adventure in my life, and I'm going to survive, and open your mind and realize that there are people who eat this every single day, and they're fine. And so you just do it. I've had some pretty unusual food, from sheep's eyeballs to incredibly fresh fish, and so almost alive fresh fish in my life that people have served me because it's the local delicacy. It's the very, you're a guest of honor, and this is what we serve our guests of honor. And the only thing you can really do, I think the culturally appropriate thing to do, is to dive in and enjoy it and enjoy the moment, and know that you're going to have a tale to take away to tell your friends back home. And I think, a critical part of travel is really abandoning some of your fears to immerse yourself in a place. And cuisine's a perfect example of that. And I really love what Seth said about asking local people, not where should I go, but where do you go? Because that's what you really want to know. Where do you take your family for a special occasion? Okay, that's where I'm going to go. That's great advice.
I should just add that I have a story that changed the way I think about sort of what we would call disgusting foods. And this took place like 15 years ago, and in New York, of all places, at a Mexican restaurant in East Harlem, and they were serving cow eye tacos, and chopped up eye, basically. Cows have very big eyes. Once you take that thing out of there, there's a lot of tacos that can come out of those eyes. Anyway, I sort of grimaced when the chef or the guy behind the counter told me about this, And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. The other tacos on this table are all cow rear end, although he didn't use the word rear end. And so it's just a sort of a question of, you know? Stuff that's kind of disgusting anyway, especially if you're not a vegetarian. So, why not a caterpillar?
Well, many cultures use different animals, obviously, in all parts of the animal. But I guess getting over the bump, how do you do that when you're really kind of repulsed by the idea of something, but you want to try it?
Well, it helps if you're on assignment and you better eat it so you can write about it.
There you go.
So, put yourself on assignment.
Don, speaking of that, you are, as we mentioned, the travel writer for National Geographic Traveler magazine. And I believe it's National Geographic that's profiling Botswana's Okavango Delta. Have you been? Is that someplace you want to visit? And why is it of interest?
I have not been. I would love to go there. It's a vast sort of relatively pristine wild place with incredible wildlife, bird life and animal life both. And you're able to see it in these wonderful pirogues that glide effortlessly through the water. And I think it would be a really spectacular experience. And it certainly is one of the places on my list to try to get this year if I can.
What is the best way to plan for a destination such as Botswana?
Well, do as much research as you can. From my point, I always pick up a traditional guidebook. I do as much reading online as I can. A place like Botswana, it's actually a really good idea in my mind to probably go with an adventure travel company because they'll make sure you have the best possible experience, and logistics in Africa especially can be really difficult. So I would research different adventure travel companies and see which one has a date that meets yours for their trip and an itinerary that appeals to you, and compare some prices and online comments, and then probably book with them for that one and go. And just make sure you get the most out of it by knowing the most before you arrive on land.
Go ahead, Seth.
Oh, yeah. No, I would just add, I actually have been to the Okavango Delta, although it was like 15 years ago. It is a great, I'm so glad to hear it's getting a lot of press, because it is really a great place to go. And I have to second, go with an experienced, outfitter to go on those things. But I wanted to add that I once did a story in which I tried to go on safari as cheaply as possible. And there are ways to do that a lot more cheaply. Kruger National Park in South Africa, which is now, it's not quite as exotic as Botswana, but people, in South Africa just take a tent, go to Kruger and go camping for a weekend to drive around and see animals. And there's no reason that someone from outside of South Africa can't do that either. South Africa is an English speaking country. And you can go, I think of the articles called something like the $125 a day safari, and that was $125 a day, including everything. So there is hope for people who want to go to these exotic locations and don't quite have the budget that some of the fancier companies charge.
All right, so, we're gonna pick up on that thread in a moment, Seth. We're up against a break here. We're talking about travel this hour of Radio Times, fascinating destinations, how to journey on a budget. Our 888-477-9499 is the number if you'd like to give us a call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We're joined this hour by Seth Kugel. He writes the Frugal Traveler column for the New York Times and is also writing a book on travel. And Don George is author of The Way of Wanderlust and columnist for National Geographic Traveler magazine, as well as special features editor and blogger for Gadling.com. We are looking at the allure of escape through travel this hour of Radio Times. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. We'll take an email as well, or at radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. So let's get into air travel for a moment. In 2015, you had American Airlines and US Air merging. Oil prices are way down. Iran is preparing to jump into the market, so who knows, they might drop even more. Are we seeing this reflected in ticket prices, Seth?
Whoa. I mean, it's with the thing with ticket prices, it all depends on where you're going and what time you're going and all that kind of stuff. I'm not an expert exactly on the trends, but certainly the combination of the big airlines is no friend to the budget traveler. So yeah, overall, I think we're going to see some bad news there and good news with oil prices.
Okay. Well, how do you go about then finding, since you are the frugal traveler, finding the best fares for a trip?
Okay. Well, I mean, first, there's a number of fantastic tools online. You know, one of my favorite is this site Hopper. They're now focusing on their app, but I love the page that's called, I'll just read it out. It's Hopper, Hopper.com/research/tools. They've hidden this a little bit, but there's this awesome thing there where you put in where you are and where you're going, and it gives you like what day is the best day to go, what's the trend, what are the nonstops, what are the full stops, and all that kind of stuff. So that's a great place to start. Then if you're really set on one specific destination, you know, I always try to advise people to try a couple different dates. Be willing to do a layover, but not such a long layover that you sort of lose a whole day of your vacation.
Sure.
But the best thing to do is if you're really concerned about budget, then choose a bunch of locations that you really want to go to and see which one you can fly to for cheaper on your dates rather than picking the location and insisting this is where I got to go. You can go to that place next year when maybe, who knows, the currency in that country has gotten weaker and it's suddenly become cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. So for the eco-conscious traveler, you know, of course, climate change is in the headlines and airplanes are big polluters, estimated to be responsible for, I think it is 2% of all the carbon dioxide emitted annually. So if you want to avoid air travel, let's look into some practical alternatives when it comes to exploring the world. Don George, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, certainly there's to get somewhere. Oftentimes, you need to get on a plane. But once you've done that and gotten there, then there's everything from buses to bullock carts, and I think you need to wrap that concern into your overall equation for what you're hoping to get out of your vacation and what your goal is. I mean, for me, I like seeing other cultures and other people, and it's hard to do that if I don't get on a plane. So I figure, all right, I'll get on a plane, and then once I'm there, I'll travel locally, trains, buses, bicycles, whatever it takes. And for me, the act of immersing myself in another culture and getting to meet people from another culture and understanding their way of life outweighs the problems I might have with the CO2. And so I think that it's worth it. But I do think that once you get on the ground from your flight, then you can pretty much rely on local transportation and reduce your footprint as much as possible that way. But I would not say it's smart to just stay home, because then the world becomes this kind of fractured place. And what I love about travel is that it brings us all closer together and teaches us about differences and how important those differences are. So I really encourage people to go out and see the world.
Seth, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that what Don just said is just perfect. You know, when you're trying to not damage the world, the environment, all that kind of stuff, think about the upside of travel as well and the positive things that come from seeing other places and maybe how much better things would be if more people had the chance to travel, which these days they are. Now, that said, I mean, I think people should just avoid the sort of around the world darting from place to place kind of trip and focus on being in one place for longer or one small region for longer. And as Don said, you can get around by bus and by train when you're there. Certainly not renting a car and taking buses or trains are also a good way to go.
So travel by ship is probably just inefficient if you're looking at time constraints.
Well,
I know. Okay, that's pretty obvious. But I mean, for the eco-conscious traveler, I guess if you want to avoid airplanes, you just have to book more time into your calendar.
You know, I did a trip recently where I took a mega bus about as far as I could go. The discount buses are now going to places you might not imagine they would go. And Philadelphia is right in the middle of all the mega bus routes. I mean, I ended up in Knoxville, Tennessee, on a mega bus. And I don't know, for living in New York, that's a pretty exotic destination. You know, you can get around a lot of the South, and these buses they're not the most comfortable things you've ever been in, But of course, buses are more environmentally friendly and also much, much cheaper. I mean, I think I spent a total of like $60 for like a 6 or 7 leg trip through the South.
Okay. Don, you'd mentioned earlier in the show that the National Park Service is celebrating its centennial this year. In your opinion, how are the national parks, like say for Yellowstone, how are they holding up as must-see destinations? Are they well maintained? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of traffic there.
There's a lot of traffic there, and there's a lot of budget restraints recently, but I still think that the national parks are this incredible, incredible treasure for the United States, and that people should get out and enjoy them. And there are the heavily trafficked parks, but there are still, Yosemite's kind of in my backyard, and I go there frequently, and there are vast open spaces in Yosemite where the visitors never get to. So it's really up to you to find those areas where you can go and be alone with nature. And they're such a great resource that really we should all take advantage of them. And we're lucky. Most of us live within close proximity to some national park, and they're perfect places to go.
So, and Seth, as we mentioned, as far as locally or in the United States is concerned, you do like off the beaten track, and you visited Dearborn, Michigan, not necessarily to explore the history of the auto industry, but to take a look at the Middle Eastern community there.
Yeah. Well, actually, I did both. I mean, the Ford Museum is there, and what an amazing museum that is. But, I was in Detroit, and I just took a day and went to Dearborn and went to all the, you know, that has a lot of Lebanese and Syrian descendants. And these are groups that have been there for, you know, decades and, you know, over half a century, actually. And so it's really neat to see a very, very sort of true Arab-American community. And with the stress really on American, I mean, it's kind of the mix of the sort of thing you might expect to see in a, you know, a Mexican neighborhood in L.A. or you know, a Puerto Rican neighborhood in New York, a real combination of sort of Lebanese and Syrian and American sort of styles and great food. So that's worth definitely a day. I mean, you know, the other place that I've been thinking about the national parks, I went to Big Bend National Park in Texas, and I think I was the only person there. You know, I mean, I think it may be the least visited national park just because it's quite far away, but like a road trip in Texas is a great idea for anyone who wants to be sort of off the beaten path. And Texas, as I'm sure many Texans would agree with me, is practically a foreign country. It certainly used to be a foreign country, and it's a great, great place to explore, and you'll easily get off the beaten track there.
Well, Seth, how do these things end up on your radar?
Oh, the thing is that my job is really just the best because, you know, I think about like what do I want to do? What do I want to know? I mean, I don't really go for like the hot. I mean, the New York Times has a great list of the hottest places, the best places to go in 2016. I tend to, you know, to look at the places that I, you know, just hear about randomly, or you see a movie, or you have a friend from there. I think one great, great way to travel is to look around you. You know, we're now a nation of every part of the United States has immigrant communities. You know, do you work with someone who's an immigrant? Where are they from? Well, maybe if you explore that place, you'll get to eat, you know, dinner with their grandmother or something like that. So, and also you may have been talking of this person, you may have been talking about their country with you for quite a long time. And just because it's not on some great list of places to go, I mean, going to places where you either know people or can get contacts before you go makes the trip so much easier, especially if the country it speaks a language that you don't speak.
Sure. Well, we've got comments and calls coming in. We've got a Facebook comment from Jay, who says, my last vacation was to Ireland, which I timed to coincide with the Irish referendum to legalize gay marriage. Thanks to Twitter, I was able to make contact with the campaign before I even left the States. Not only did I get all the usual touristy stuff, but I made a small but meaningful contribution to Irish history in the process when the referendum passed. He says, never go on vacation without an agenda. So it is smart to plan ahead and to really have a goal and then to work that out as much as possible before you get there.
I mean, I think it's really a fun thing to do. It's a great way to go on a mission, whatever that mission is, if it's time to current events or something you really care about. or even a kind of food. It gives you a mission, and it also gives you a thing to talk to people about once you're there. Like, what if you're obsessed, I don't know, with coffee or something like that, and then you go to a place that has great coffee. It could be just a city in Italy, or it could be a place that produces coffee, and you just ask around and say to everyone, you know, where's the best place to get coffee? Where's the most interesting place that produces coffee? Whatever that sort of thing is. Or it could be, you know, any topic that you're interested in, giving your trip a mission automatically kind of forces you into social interactions, and it never leaves you thinking like, oh, what should I do today?
Okay, let's get to some stuff in the news recently. I read today that the State Department is asking those who have passports, which expired this year, do it now. Get that passport, re-up your passport now, because they're just expecting a crush of renewals. And you might find yourself without when you need to go on your trip. Don, have you ever run into passport trouble?
I have, actually. I didn't realize a few years ago when I was taking a trip overseas, I didn't realize that my passport expired. I think it was within 3 months or something, and the country I was going to required that my passport be valid for 6 months, I think it was. So I ended up having to go to the U.S. passport office in San Francisco and expediting my passport that way. I mean, there are ways to expedite your passport if you need to. You end up having to pay more. But that warning was really great for people to heed. I mean, basically, you get your passport application in as soon as you possibly can, because you don't know, you don't have control over how long it's going to take to get that renewal or to get your first passport. So, and more people are traveling, and more people are trying to get passports. So just plan ahead and know what the various requirements of the places you're going are, because even if your passport is valid, as in my case, for 2 months, that might not actually be enough.
Yeah, I'd read, too, that many countries apparently are asking for at least 6 months of validity left on passports. And I don't know if you've run into that or heard that, but that's an important note.
That's a really important consideration that you wouldn't necessarily think about till you get to the airport, and then it's a little bit too late.
Yeah. Okay, so also in the news recently, and I'd like to kind of move this into questions about travelers insurance, but first let's talk about the Zika virus, which is spread by mosquitoes, found in countries across the world. It's big in Latin America right now, and unfortunately, especially as it pertains to women who are pregnant or who are even thinking about becoming pregnant. I think El Salvador, Colombia, a number of Latin American countries are just asking women who, again, are pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant to reconsider their travel plans there, because it can result in the birth of a baby in which the brain is harmed. So it's a very tough and even tragic situation in many instances. So is the advice not only for Zika, but for other health concerns, say if you've had a heart attack or other health issues, to have a conversation with your doctor before you book your trip? Seth?
I think it's very important. My doctor has, you know, specific travel appointments, and he'll sit there with you and go through all the health risk in the places that you're going. And I certainly encourage people to do that. The Zika virus is such a scary thing, especially for women. I mean, I used to live in Brazil, and I have a friend down there who's putting off having a second child until it's done. And so it's a real concern. Some concerns are not quite as real, like people can be afraid of something, you know, malaria, and then it turns out they're not even going to the part of the country that has malaria. So it's really important to get the exact right information and about specific parts of a country rather than the country as a whole, because people, there's the time when it's correct to kind of panic and take stuff like Zika very, very seriously. And then there's times where people go over the top with their, you know, obsession about diseases that are actually quite infrequent.
This brings us to travel insurance, though, because if you do happen to become ill while you are abroad, my understanding is the rules can be really different as far as insurance is concerned. You know, you might have a great plan here in the United States, but it might not necessarily translate into your destination in Europe or Africa or South America. Don?
Right. The crucial thing is for the traveler to beware and be wary and absolutely know what you're already covered for and find out what your provider's policies are and procedures are. I think getting travel insurance in most cases is a really good idea, just in case anything could happen, from a natural disaster that makes it impossible for you to take your trip, to something actually going wrong when you're in country. I think it's a great hedge to make sure that you don't lose all of your valuable money when something goes wrong on a trip. And in terms of health, certainly there some things are covered. I know that my policy covered my children's illness when they got sick overseas and we had to go to a hospital. We got reimbursed for our expenses, but other things aren't covered. So you really need to know what's exactly in your plan and then plan accordingly.
And Seth, I've read that many hospitals, foreign hospitals, actually ask for the money up front.
My only experience in a foreign hospital, I actually just wrote about it, was in Germany, and they still haven't asked for the money, and it's months later. Yeah, you know, the thing, I have a slightly different take on travel insurance. I think that there's a lot of travel insurance companies making a lot of money off of people who aren't reading the details very carefully. One thing that's such a huge, huge difference is whether your insurance covers you at all abroad or not. You know, Medicare won't cover you in a foreign country. So people who are on Medicare have to get travel insurance, you know, and whereas a private health insurance, I have called every insurance that I've ever had and said, tell me exactly what's going to happen if I am, you know, abroad and something happens. And the fact of the matter is, like a blanket travel insurance company is charging people who aren't covered at all abroad and people who are largely covered abroad the same amount. And that's a bad purchase for someone who is mostly covered, their health is mostly covered abroad. So, you know, there are other insurances that will be more specific and cover you for certain things. So the most important thing is the only insurance I have is evacuation insurance. So if something really horrible happens, I can get flown back to the United States. Whereas I trust my own insurance because I've spoken to them about getting reimbursed for stuff in a hospital. Now, the hospitals may ask for money up front. Hopefully they take a credit card. But you should always travel with a certain amount of cash on you anyway.
Yeah, and other notes before we hit the break here. Credit cards can actually offer some coverage, and homeowners, renters, or car insurance policies. So it pays to do your homework. Okay, again, we're focusing on travel this hour of Radio Times, how to journey on a budget, also security, health, destinations, all sorts of things. 888-477-9499 is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. Or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. More in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We're joined this hour by Don George, author of The Way of Wanderlust and columnist for National Geographic Traveler magazine, and also Seth Kugel. He writes the Frugal Traveler column for the New York Times and is also writing a book on travel. Lines are open. 888-477-9499 is the number. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So let's get to the phones. Francis in New Jersey is standing by. Welcome, Francis, to Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question. I am a senior citizen. I'm actually 78 years old. Last time I was traveling was when I was 75, and everything was accomplished, the travel trip through a friend of mine. We had gone to Cuba, and it was with the OAT, Overseas Adventure Travel, with a small group of 18 people. Now I've decided to go back on the road again, but I'm wondering, is there any place that on the net or some website that is geared to the senior traveler? I've been thinking about going to England, Scotland, or Wales, Switzerland or Austria, or maybe Norway, finally Calgary. The OAT has one or usually 15 days on up. I'm looking for something between 8 and 10 at the most because of my age. Is there a website that look for something like that?
All right.
The senior citizen is what I'm concerned about.
Thank you, Don. Thanks for the, or I should say Francis, for the call to Radio Times, and good luck in your travels. Don, what do you think?
Well, two things leap to mind. I mean, certainly all the countries that you mentioned are pretty senior friendly, I would say. And in terms of traveling with a group, which you may want to do because there's a certain amount of comfort in having someone else take care of your arrangements and also knowing that they provide a kind of safety net. There's a lot of adventure travel companies that offer all kinds of tours of all kinds of length. And if you do some research online into just different adventure travel company offerings, you'll find ones that are 8 days or 10 days and for the season that you're wanting to go. And I'd encourage you, I mean, England certainly is a wonderful place to go, and they have great facilities for seniors. I think any of the places you mentioned, and I think it's wonderful that you're excited about getting out there again, and I wish you very happy travels, and I think you'll be happy in any of the places that you mentioned.
And Seth Kugel?
Yeah, I mean, I would like, actually, I can make a specific recommendation. I've never been on one of these trips, but my parents are great travelers, and they are always raving about Rick Steves' tour groups in Europe. And, you know, they are 77 and 85, and, you know, it's a mixed group. It's not just older folks, but they are very, very well taken care of. And so, you know, that's what I would recommend.
So, Seth, you've traveled with your parents on 5 trips. What are the benefits and challenges of traveling with family?
Well, I think we all know the challenges, right? You know, the benefits, of course, are for someone who doesn't see their parents or lives in another city or another state or even another country. It's just the solid time to spend with people. Of course, the downside is you move at different paces, and you know, you have to be slower when necessary. But on the other hand, it's just a great way to, you know, bond and spend time with folks. Those are some of my favorite trips. The other advantage of if you're used to traveling alone, or if you're always traveling with your partner or whatever, having another perspective changes things completely. You know, my parents are interested in things that I'm not interested in, and vice versa. And that forces you to do things you wouldn't have done otherwise. They basically insisted in Panama that we go to the new the Frank Gehry Museum. That's called the Bio Museum. And it's something that I probably just went, whatever. You know, I'd rather go walk around the neighborhoods and eat street food. And it's a fantastic museum.
Okay. Don, you write in The Way of Wanderlust. I guess one of the perks of being a travel writer is that your bosses can just up and say, take your family to the Galapagos, which you did. And you write of the beauty of the Galapagos Islands. But while you were there, you had to compete with the digital images of the islands that were in your head, complete with James Earl Jones narration. We see so much from the comfort of our homes. How do you prevent that from lessening the real travel experience? How do you fight that?
Right. Well, the Galapagos was the perfect example of that. I actually went on a Geographic Expeditions trip to the Galapagos, and it was the best family trip of our lives, and it actually changed my children's lives. So when Seth was talking about his family travels, that was the one that came immediately to my mind. My daughter became a marine biologist because of the adventures we had with sea lions in the Galapagos.
Oh, wow.
So they really can be life-changing family trips. But you get on the ground with all of these, you know, PBS images in your mind from these wonderful wildlife documentaries. And, of course, what happens happily is suddenly you see a turtle, a tortoise right in front of you, or you see a blue-footed booby right in front of you, and you realize that the TV is a very, very small world compared to the vast world of the Galapagos. And suddenly, it wasn't too hard to make that leap. But before I got to the Galapagos, I was really afraid that it couldn't possibly measure up to those edited, beautifully produced documentaries that I'd seen. But then, of course, you're surrounded by the screeching of the birds and the swash of the waves, and it's a whole new world that really has a profound effect on everybody. And my son and daughter and wife and I all had a treasure of an experience there that we still remember and talk about to this day. It's become a threading part of our lives, and that's priceless.
Oh, a nice plug for the real life experience. Okay, let's get back to the phones. Walter in Garnet Valley, you are live on Radio Times. Hi, Walter.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I are taking a repositioning trip in March, going from Florida to San Juan, St. Thomas, St. John's, and Tenerife, in Spain. And then the next thing you know, we're in Malaga, Spain, Marseille. My question is, on most of these, you're there from 9 to 5 or 8 to 4 or some passage, and then you're back on the ship. What's the best thing to do, or any clues on any of those cities of what you can't miss?
Seth, why don't you tackle that? Are these places that are familiar to you somewhat?
You know, some of them are. I mean, Malaga, you got to, I guess you got to go to the Picasso Museum. You know, so certain must visit places. One of the things I like to do, of course, when you're getting off a ship, you're always at risk of just following the pack everywhere. But one of my favorite things to do is just check out a map or read about a city before I go there and just pick a neighborhood. And spend the entire time wandering around that specific neighborhood. And if it happens to be the neighborhood that has the Picasso Museum, that's great. But I think the most important thing is to try not to do too much in that period of time, because then you're just rushing around. I would say maybe pick one attraction and then wander around for the rest of the time.
All right. Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Kathleen, welcome to Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I was calling because my son recently went to Canada on a trip, and when you were talking about the insurance before, I thought it was really great. It was a college planned trip, and they told them that they had to have insurance for if they were skiing, and if they were on the mountain and had to be airlifted off for any reason, they had to have insurance for that, or else it was going to be very expensive. So I had never thought about getting insurance before.
Okay. Don, any thoughts?
I think it's very important. As Seth mentioned, evacuation insurance is really important. Trip cancellation insurance is something else you might want to think about. But you don't want to be in a dicey situation in a foreign country and not have a way to get out. You need to have some backup where a helicopter is going to come and get you to the nearest hospital or get you home.
Especially if you're doing something like an adventure trip, a ski trip, mountain
right.
climbing, that sort of thing. Sure.
Exactly.
Okay. We've got an email from Patrick. Wellsboro, Pennsylvania, home of the Pennsylvania Grand Canyon in Tioga County, is an amazing place to visit and very affordable. I hadn't heard of the Pennsylvania Grand Canyon. Seth, you're the one who's out in the beaten path. Is that something you've heard of?
Never heard of it. Sounds good to me.
Okay, something new. So, Seth, you've authored an article entitled Parents in Tow, Finding a Charming and Cheap Corner of Panama. And right off the top, you write, the first Panamanian I met promptly handed me a baby. Tell us about that.
So I met my parents in the Panama City airport. We rented a car, and we were just driving out to this place called the Azuero Peninsula, which I had chosen because a friend of a friend of a. I met a Panamanian guy a couple years ago on Thanksgiving. Got back in touch with him. He put me in touch with a friend who recommended this peninsula. So we were trying to find a place that wasn't too much explored. We were driving there, and just along the way, I spotted this little roadside shack, which was sort of very picturesque, almost a little too picturesque. And I just said, we got to stop and get a milkshake, which is what they sold. And we just pulled over. My parents sort of stayed by the car. I went over. And I walked in, and I ordered a shake, and literally the woman was the only person there, and she was holding her baby, and she's just like, hold this, please. And, that's the sort of thing that happens when you, go by instinct, I think. One of the things I've noticed that works very well for me is that whenever I have an idea, like, well, maybe I should do this. That looks like an interesting place. I've never heard of it, but maybe I should stop there. The answer is always yes, you definitely should stop there. Because it's not every single place that will happen, but what a welcome to a country. I was holding a baby.
Baby. And yeah, she had no problem with that, the baby, huh?
What's that?
She had no problem with that.
Well, I mean, it just also is an immediate sort of welcome to another culture,
sure.
Right? I mean, I can't even imagine even someone working with a baby in their hands in a New York City, ice cream shop or something. It's just so foreign. And then to have her hand the baby over as if it were nothing was just an amazing way to start a trip, and certainly an endorsement for being more adventurous when you travel.
A nice warm welcome. Don, traveling is obviously not all about viewing and listening and eating. High on your list of things to do as a wanderer, I've read in The Way of Wanderlust, was to touch a whale, and you did manage to do that. Why don't you tell us about it? Those animals are huge. Did you not have any fear?
That was extraordinary. It was in the Sea of Cortez down in Baja, California. And, we really didn't have fear. I mean, I was on a trip. I was actually with the Lindblad people on a trip where the naturalists were so great that they absolutely prepared us for what was going to happen. And we were out in our zodiacs, and a mother whale and baby whale came up and befriended us, and for about a half hour we had what I called an interspecies play date, where the baby whale was literally, the way that we push rubber duckies in our bathtubs, the baby whale was pushing our zodiac, playing with us, basically. And there was a moment when the whale came right up under the zodiac, and we'd been told that it was fine to touch them, just be respectful, sort of. And the sort of sandpapery feel of the whale's skin gliding under my hand is truly something I'll never forget. Right now I'm feeling it as I'm saying these words. And it was one of the most profoundly moving experiences of my life. And then it ended with the mother whale coming to sort of say goodbye to us, and she slid right under us, and there was a moment when I looked directly into the eye of the mother whale and felt like I had suddenly touched some kind of profound wisdom that was way beyond anything I understood about this planet. And it was really an extraordinary moment of interspecies connection. It's kind of the heart of what I'm going for when I travel. And boy, that experience changed my life in some ways.
Well, certainly a reason to expand our concept of travel.
Yeah.
All right, so we've got time for a few more calls, I think. Mary in Wayne, you are live on Radio Times. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi. My husband and I are arguing because I want to go to Angkor Wat in Southeast Asia, a few places. You know, he's still working. I'm retired. He has hemochromatosis. He needs to donate blood 4 times a year, and he's saying there's disease-resistant malaria now, and antibiotic resistant, and so now he wants to head to Scotland. And my thinking is, I'm 68. That's the kind of trip I can do now. I can do Scotland in my 70s, riding around in the car and looking at castles and distilleries. My question is there, is there a lot? Do tourists pick up a lot of malaria when they go to Southeast Asia, or do they spray a lot, or what can you recommend?
Can you be protected against it before you leave? What have you heard, Seth?
Well, I'm certainly not a medical expert, but I do know that tourists get malaria. That it's certainly a danger. Of course, there's all kinds of options for what you can take to prevent it. There's, of course, you do everything you can to prevent from getting bitten. But at the end of the day, I think that's a question for the doctors. I don't know. Maybe Dr. Don has something to say about that.
Well, I've been to lots of malaria in countries that have malaria, and there are certainly medications you can take before you go. And I do like what you're saying about putting off the easier to visit countries until a little bit later, and some of the more challenging countries get to now. I mean, Angkor Wat is really an extraordinary place that everybody should visit once in their lives at least. And then there are regions around Siem Reap that are really amazing too. So I would really encourage you to go there, but of course to consult with your doctor first.
Yes.
And make sure you take all the necessary precautions and don't do anything unduly risky, but get there and enjoy it.
And good luck. Thank you, Mary, for the call to Radio Times. So we've got about 30 seconds. Don, what is next on your travel list?
I am going to Japan. I'm going to the island of Shikoku. I'll be in Kyoto for the cherry blossom time, and then I'm going to Shikoku after that. And Shikoku is a wonderful, off-the-beaten-track place that I dearly love, so I'm looking forward to that.
Have fun, Seth.
Well, amazingly, I've just done my last trip as Frugal Traveler, so I am going to take a little break from travel, exotic travel, and I'm actually going, my next trip is literally going to see some friends in Philadelphia next weekend.
Oh, well, you'll have to stop by the WHYY studios. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us here on Radio Times. It's been a fun hour. Seth Kugel, for the moment, writes the Frugal Traveler column for the New York Times and is working on a book on travel. Seth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Don George, it's been a pleasure. Don is author of The Way of Wanderlust and editor-at-large for National Geographic Traveler magazine. Thanks, Don.
Thank you, Mary. That was a fun journey.
Oh, thank you. And as always, we invite you to check out our Facebook page and podcasts. You can find them at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Our intern is Nick Kowalski. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.